Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impacts these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. Our first guest was appointed CEO of the Canadian Securities Exchange in July 2011. An early advocate for the cannabis industry, the CSE is now the global exchange leader in the listings of issuers in the space. Recognized by Financial Post magazine as one of Canada's 25 cannabis industry power players and a recipient of the American Trade Association's Captain of the Industry Award in November 2018, please welcome Richard Carlton. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Heather. My pleasure.
And our next guest is a Canna Week regular. He's a pioneering thought leader in the cannabis industry. He has developed market-leading forecasts for the growth of the industry, uncovered groundbreaking insights into the cannabis consumer, and led the first-of-its-kind analysis of global cannabis demand. Please welcome our Chief Knowledge Officer here at New Frontier Data, John Kikia.
Good to be back, Heather. Thank you.
Always great to have you. Well, we have lots to cover, so we're going to dive right in. Last week, Yahoo Finance published an article titled, "This VC Firm Has Predicted Big Cannabis Would Shrink. What Happens Next?" So as Canada legalized adult use in 2018, a lot of countries have looked at them as kind of a blueprint for how to operate on a national scale. When the industry first came online, capital was flowing freely, and investors were excited at the prospect of getting on the ground level of a new consumer market in North America. But since then, as we know, the Canadian cannabis market, like many others throughout the globe, has undergone a serious, significant market corrections and now dealing with this international pandemic. All these factors have brought about reductions in mergers and acquisitions activity, stock valuations, and operational footprints. And companies have been compelled to streamline operations and adjust their growth strategies. So I guess what we want to hear is, what are the biggest changes that we've been seeing in the Canadian cannabis capital market since the onset of adult use legalization?
Thank you, Heather. Well, obviously, as the Yahoo article pointed out, there has been both a constrainment of capital being made available to the industry, and there's been a change in the character of the capital as well. And understand, we at the Canadian Securities Exchange have a lot of insight into the trends, because not only, of course, did we take a leading role in the capitalization of the industry in Canada, but all of the U.S. Public multi-state operators are also listed on the Canadian Securities Exchange, which has given us extremely good visibility into trends in the United States as well. You know, the Canadian story is really a case where in many respects, the companies, the early companies, the Tweeds, the Ifrias, the Auroras, and so on, were very much treated like private equity-backed type companies. They were given a lot of cash, and company management was encouraged by their investors, by their boards, by their advisors, to really grow at all costs, you know, to make sure that every piece of the game was covered. Whether it was cultivation, extraction, product development, moves from dried flower products into edibles, beverages, and then obviously international expansion, looking at lower cost cultivation jurisdictions, whether it was in South America or Southern Africa or Asia even, as well as obviously acquiring licenses in different jurisdictions in Europe as they appear to liberalize at least their medical regimes. So, and management's feet really weren't being held to the fire on profitability or EBITDA positivity or so on. You know, the thing that investors were rewarding at that stage was just that growth, you know, at all costs, make the investments all over the place. You know, we don't know how this is going to work out, but we want to make sure that we've got basically some chips down on every one of these opportunities as they present themselves. And, you know, that obviously changed very quickly. The valuations, because it's a public market, it's not a private equity market where capital is intended to be, or by definition is going to be more patient with a 5 to 7 to 10 year horizon for an investment return. Here you've got investors, analysts, advisors that are obviously held to a quarterly benchmark in many cases. And you began to see the sentiment of the investor community change as these companies burned more and more cash, seizing these opportunities. And instead of narrowing that line of cash consumed versus revenues generated, you know, they were in fact getting farther and farther away from it and began to suffer the consequences from that. So again, we saw less capital beginning to flow into those companies. They had a harder time raising money to pursue additional opportunities. And, you know, it has to be said that virtually every one of the senior management teams of those companies is now gone. They've been replaced by folks who have a clearer mandate to trim costs, to optimize operations, to exit opportunities that show no immediate prospects of return in an effort to try to bring these companies to profitability. So that's on the operating side. On the other side of the coin, I may have made a face for the viewers when you talked about international jurisdictions looking at Canada as a blueprint. It may be a blueprint, but there's a blueprint of a lot of things that also that weren't done very well. That also hurt the companies because the Canadian LPs had an expectation that there was going to be an opportunity to compete with the illicit market. And as we all know, one of the unique aspects, at least dating back to alcohol prohibition in the 20s and 30s in North America, is that we know there's a huge consumer market for this for the products. It's there. It's just a case of the legal market displacing the illicit market in a variety of jurisdictions around North America. So in order to be able to do that, though, the legal market needs to provide good quality products at a reasonable price in a retail environment that consumers are comfortable with, is able to engage through marketing, education, sales activities. And that's simply, those conditions weren't in place in Canada in most jurisdictions. In fact, the local governments were deeply conflicted on their support because in Canada, this wasn't a popular measure that was approved by plebiscite or referendum type propositions on the ballots in various states in 2016, 2018, and so on. This was basically the federal government thinking this up and doing it and then downloading the hard questions like zoning, licensing, regulations around advertising, and so on to the provincial and local governments. And many of these provincial and local governments weren't, in fact, philosophically on side with the move. Now, I think they were wrong for the record, but it was a fact that retail, particularly in the most populous province in Canada, Ontario, where I happen to live, was deeply, deeply flawed. And so, for example, for the first year, only 25 retail licenses, so that 25 locations for a province with a population of, 14, 15 million people, were available. It was grossly underserved. So on the one hand, you've got companies that are increasingly being held to sales and revenue measures that a normal public company would. On the other hand, their ability to compete with the illicit market and to be able to grow that sales volume domestically was being hampered by the slow pace of the regulations and in some cases some very poor regulations that are implemented by the local governments. So they really got caught in a squeeze from really both sides.
Yeah, I mean, well, you guys were the first, so it's kind of understandable that you're going to make mistakes when you're the first people to kind of take over this market. One quote that was in that article was from the CEO of Canopy Rivers. He said his prediction that vertical integration doesn't work. He's like, you can't be everything to everyone. When you had cash flowing in and it was great, it was easy to keep up that and try to expand your footprint and get bigger and bigger. But he's saying when stuff starts to get a little tight with money, you can't be everything to everyone. You can't do everything well. Would you agree with that?
I put it slightly differently, and I've been saying this for some period of time. Name me one industry where the farmers make the money. There isn't one. Even as necessary as they are for the for the completed product, but I can grow the best hops in the world, but I'm pretty sure that Anheuser-Busch is going to make the high margins, and that I'm going to get squeezed as the primary producer of one of the constituent products on an annual basis from the from that market. So, you know, the fact that, you know, these companies were having to spend millions and billions acquiring cultivation capacity, which is a very, very capital intensive, likelihood a low margin business, especially up here in the Northern Hemisphere, where it's got to be done indoors with lots of energy applied during the winter months and everything, was going to make that a very, very difficult business plan to execute on. And I think we've seen the companies look to shed those sorts of assets and acquire finished product from third parties. And then what they're good at is, you know, again, as a consumer packaged goods company, thinking about product positioning, price levels, quality, and to the extent that they can advertise, market, and engage in consumer education and so on, do those activities as well.
Right. John, what's your opinion on this?
So just to echo Richard's point about the farmers not making the money, I'm in Kenya. I'm doing this interview from Kenya, and I have an uncle who runs a coffee farm. And I remember his first time going to a Starbucks and being aghast that what he was being paid for a pound of his raw beans is what they were charging for a cup in Starbucks. Which shows that, you know, the farmer was not the one who's making the money on this prime Kenyan coffee. It was Starbucks. And I think with cannabis, we're absolutely seeing that same level of commoditization, and particularly going and growing in the Northern Hemisphere, where the cost of production indoor in winter, even if you've got the most energy efficient facility in the world, it is going to be a very resource intensive thing to do. But also echoing Richard's point about some of the challenges that, Canadian operators in particular faced at the outset of this market. You know, one of the aspects that I think led to that initial frothing in this market between, say, 2014, really spiking 2016 through that period through 2018, was very unrealistic expectations about how long it takes a market to get from the point of legalization to the point where it's running a viable, sustainable, efficient, revenue-generating market. And so we saw this in Canada, where, you know, in some respects, it was relatively easy to get legalization through. The advocates might say that it was a really challenging thing. But broadly speaking, it was a fairly kind of efficient process for them to get the law passed. But actually implementing that law into a viable, sustainable market was a phenomenally challenging thing to do. And they still haven't ironed out all of the kinks. And that's been broadly true, even in the North American, in the U.S. markets at the state level, but because the U.S. state markets tend to be smaller, a little more agile, a little more flexibly managed than you see when you start trying to deploy a national scale market. I don't think stakeholders outside the U.S. understood that trying to do this at the national level is going to be a far messier affair than you would see if you're trying to take Colorado as a comparator market for how this happens. And then you look outside of North America, and we also think there were very unrealistic expectations about how quickly the global dominoes were going to fall, whether that was in how quickly things like the German or Australian markets were going to have patients participating in those programs and those patients consuming significant volumes of product, or whether it was going to be how quickly you'd be able to establish viable cultivation facilities in Latin America, in Asia, and in Southern Africa. And so, you know, part of the recalibration that we're seeing now, I think, is a very appropriate transition away from what I believe has been too much irrational exuberance, with a much more clear-eyed, much more sober assessment about how this cannabis opportunity is going to evolve. And I think what investors are saying now is that, right, we get it. There's clearly opportunity in this market. From our assessment, if we're talking about a global cannabis consumer economy today that is valued at approximately $350 billion, the demand is absolutely there and consumers are spending money on this. But it is going to take a while to establish a market that can effectively transition these consumers from the unregulated market to the legal one. And for investors, you have to understand that while the opportunity exists, this is not going to be an overnight turnkey sensational growth market, but one which the operators who have the most strategic implementation, the most focused approach, and who have a really acute understanding of what their both near-term and long-term path to profitability are going to be, are going to be best suited to both be profitable today, but also capture this market opportunity as it evolves into the future.
Yeah, John, I absolutely agree with that assessment. And in fact, I think in many respects, some of the U.S. jurisdictions are now farther ahead of the Canadian jurisdictions, where we see, again, some of our companies like Cresco and Curaleaf and Trueleaf and Green Thumb Industries and so on, which have shown just tremendous revenue growth in their home markets of Illinois and Florida and California and so on. And they do have seem to be, and my view for what it's worth is that the ability for them to create a very compelling consumer experience to engage in sales and marketing activities like any consumer packaged goods company would, by and large, has really helped them get over the hump and drive towards significant sales growth and through, in fact, in some cases, full-on profitability at this point. This isn't the end state by any stretch of the imagination, because, of course, we still have all of the issues confronting operators in the United States related to banking and supply chains that are limited to single jurisdictions, the 280E tax issues for corporations. You still have some jurisdictions that limit the ability of public companies to access licensing. And again, as you point out, the licensing regime in a number of jurisdictions in the U.S. is, I guess I'll be polite and say chaotic.
Are you saying it's complicated here in the U.S.? Is that what you're getting at?
Well, in some areas, yes. We have seen, I think, the dawn of what it takes to be successful in the space. But in terms of the 9-inning ball game, we're probably still somewhere in the first inning, I think, at this point, in terms of who ultimately captures a meaningful market share and profitability.
Agreed.
Yeah. Well, since John, you touched on a little bit on international expansion, Our next article, Investor Business Daily, reported earlier this week that marijuana stocks fall amid industry's latest international pullback. So as we talked about, a lot of the larger Canadian LPs have really been focused on expansion, which also include international markets. And as John mentioned just recently, that the realities of the speed of which these markets are ready to expand, they just weren't there. And across the industry, longer-term plans have really been shelved in order to prioritize this path towards near-term sustainable profitability. So Richard, how have you seen LPs, balance this near-term strategic growth with long-term expansion planning?
Yeah, I guess the mistake that the Canadian LPs made, and again, I don't think it was necessarily a mistake because they were being cheered on by the investment community at that time. Those investments or acquisitions were being done. But, again, we have to appreciate that in most jurisdictions of the world, and it may actually be like UK, Canada, the United States, New Zealand, and Australia that are the jurisdictions that legalize for recreational use, the rest of the world's medical, which is a completely different mindset, path to market, supply chains, engagement, because, obviously in the medical markets, you have to be, top of mind with the physicians and the pharmacy folks in order to ensure that your product is being prescribed or made available to address, a number of different health conditions. Different market altogether than a consumer packaged goods market that effectively you're looking at, as I say, today in Canada, the United States, and I expect in the other parts of what is referred to as, I guess, the old Commonwealth, John. So I think that was part of the thought process was that Germans and French and Italians and Danish people, whatever, they smoke lots of weed. Let's, you know, dive in there. And, you know, there's a potential big sales opportunity. But again, addressing that opportunity was going to take a completely different skill set and path to market, and probably even a longer time to build material sales volume than you would in an adult use market.
Right. Well, John, I know your team has done a lot of work and look at the global markets. What are your thoughts on this?
So I completely echo everything Richard has just said. And maybe just two points to add to that. One is this idea of when you go medical, particularly the way some of the European markets are treating cannabis as a medical compound, not only do you face a much higher burden in terms of getting the healthcare community to buy into medical cannabis, you know, we're still in an ecosystem where, broadly speaking, medical cannabis as a medicinal therapy is not being taught in most medical schools. So there's a lot of ground level education that has to be done. And there's in this kind of laissez-faire approach to medical cannabis that you've seen in the US, where, broadly speaking, physicians who think that you could benefit from it will be willing to write you a recommendation. Just the protocols of healthcare practice in Europe in particular, I think at a much higher, at a different type of threshold that will make the deep ingress of medical cannabis as a widely prescribed therapeutic much, much more difficult to do. And then second is, it being treated like a true medicinal therapy, almost close to the standard of a pharmaceutical, means that the scientific standards which you have to produce, not just the product quality, but the science that has to affirm the recommendation or prescription of cannabis, has to be at a much higher standard than we've seen historically in North America. And candidly, I think a lot of these LPs have just underestimated how challenging it would be to overcome those hurdles. And then third is the consumer orientation. So to Richard's point, a lot of Europeans consume a lot of cannabis. There's no question about that. But it's a very different proposition when you're now saying that, you know, your only line of access is going to have to be you having a hard conversation with your physician, convincing him to that you need it, convincing him that it is safe for him to write you this recommendation, and having to go through this as a truly clinical kind of white glove process, which candidly, you know, for the recreational consumer, those are a lot of hoops to go through. That's a lot of kind of personal exposure that I don't think many were willing to do. And it's going to take a while until you have that psychic shift happen across European society, where you have the sort of level of embrace of medicinal cannabis that you've seen in North America.
And John, to the point there, all of that has added considerable cost at the, in effect, at the consumer level in Europe, so that, again, as far as competing with the illicit market or the existing market or whatever the polite way of referring to it is, it is extremely difficult to compete when you're three times the cost. It's that order of magnitude, I think, between the legal and the illicit market. But it is fascinating, in talking with colleagues from France and Germany and some of the other large European jurisdictions. I always felt that one of the more compelling arguments, particularly for those of us in Canada and the northern U.S. states that didn't have a legacy grow operation culture, and I'm, I guess, referring to our friends in Northern California and Oregon, Washington, and parts of Colorado. You've obviously had a significant source of revenue for organized crime. And that was an enormous part of the overall illicit market. And that is doubly true in Europe. But I haven't heard that conversation, going on at the political level as a justification as to why there should be further liberalization or a change in tack from a medical market to an adult use market. Because when you consider who the bad guys are in Europe, that are in control of the trade. They're way worse than the ones we have in North America, and I'll leave it at that.
So interesting point there. And maybe part of the reason for that, Richard, I think is The illicit market component that I think was led to some of the strong support for legalization that you saw stateside was more on the effect that it was having on the consumers who were being prosecuted rather than in an effort to capture the revenues that was being earned by the unregulated market. Yes, taxation revenue was part of the argument, but I think kind of the human cost, the societal cost of prohibition enforcement was a catalyst for seeing that transition in places like Colorado, Oregon, and California. And for some reason that because, I mean, maybe because the Europeans have not been as punitive in their enforcement of against consumers, you know, they've been willing to turn a blind eye to their much more aggressive, organized entities that are running the unregulated markets there. But because, you know, that's not downstreaming into you know, Uncle Sam and Auntie Jane being arrested for cannabis, there's been less kind of public focus on the idea of needing to dismantle prohibition in its current form.
Yeah, I think that's a really good explanation, John. I think you're right, because there's no doubt that that is, I think, was a significant factor. And, you know, one of the little factoids that always, wasn't amusing, made me quite sad, actually, but to see the who was funding the opposition to the adult use propositions in a number of states was the prison lobby. And I felt if I was on the other side of a debate from the U.S. prison lobby, I felt that my moral compass was pointing pretty much in the right direction. So...
Well, jumping back a little bit to what we were talking about before, as far as companies learning that they can't be all things to all people, Richard, what area do you think is a little still undercapitalized at this stage of the market's growth?
That's a good question. I mean, what I can tell you is what we're seeing now. So the cannabis issuers on the Canadian Securities Exchange, even with the constraints, have raised 1.25 billion Canadian. In the first 6 months of this year. So there's still a significant interest from various investors, Canadian, US, and overseas, in the segment. The companies that are attracting the capital, again, tend to be the US MSOs. The price tag on that capital has tended to go up. It's more likely to be a convertible offering with a coupon at this point, although we're starting to see some straight equity deals again as valuations have improved since the pandemic began. But I think, you know, it's abundantly clear that there are still opportunities, again, for the solid operators who understand the consumer packaged goods market. There are lots more states to come on board. You know, things are looking very promising in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania. I even hear folks in Texas talking about the likelihood of medical programs being approved in Texas with the Florida model in place, which would give entrepreneurs substantial room to run. So I think the short answer there is a lot of investment opportunity left without leaving North America. And in particular in the United States, I'm very excited to see how the industry is going to develop over the next 3 to 5 years.
John, what's your take on that?
So one I think that we're watching quite closely, and I think is just fascinating because it speaks to this idea that we're really still at the tip of this iceberg. To me, is the consumer product side of this ecosystem. So flower, by and large now nationally, at least in the US, accounts for a little over 50% of the product being sold, down from over 90% when these states first started legalizing and everybody was smoking before you had a viable edibles and topicals and vapes in the space. But even as you look at these new product categories, the edibles, the topicals, the vapes, in many respects, these are all, you know, relatively rudimentary forms of these products. And I mean that from two angles. On the edible side in particular, you know, the product formulations have come a long way, but we think there's still tremendous room for innovation left in both what types of products are being infused with cannabis, as well as how they're being formulated. But also second, just in the kind of product branding. you know, for most consumers who are transitioning from an unregulated market to a legal one, most of them generally didn't know what they were consuming. Most of them were consuming flour, and they were happy to get whatever they could get. So there was a really unsophisticated kind of orientation to the spectrum of cannabis and cannabinoids, the variants in experiences that you could have with different cannabis products, or the types of amplified experiences that you could have when you combine cannabis with other botanicals to enhance certain aspects of the experience. And we're seeing companies starting to experiment with that. I look at a company like 1906 in Colorado that have just come out with a new line of what they call drops, which are cannabis-based pills that they've selected. They've traveled the world finding natural botanicals that enhance the types of effects that you experience with the cannabinoids that are in these pills. And this product was 4 years in the making. They had to work with lab scientists out of 3M to figure out a new way to constitute these products to deliver a hyper-consistent experience. But they've really kind of broken new ground. And why use that as an example? Even as we're building this product, industry stakeholders were telling them cannabis consumers don't consume cannabis in pill form. There's no segment for this. This is a 1%, maybe 2% part of the market. Yet when they launched this product, even though they had a very successful line of chocolate edibles up until that point, they did what they thought was going to be a year's worth of sales in a little less than 3 months. Huge demand. Consumers really appreciated kind of that these were products that did what they said in the jar on the label and did it in a really elegant way. And it just goes to show that, you know, accepting consumers at face value in terms of them saying what they want, they don't know what they want because they haven't seen yet what the possibilities are. And so for the innovators, for the risk takers who are going to be defining the next chapter of the cannabis product ecosystem, we think there's still huge room for innovation. To not just innovate with the types of genetics and experiences that can be produced with cannabis, but in the types of products that can be created by constituting and mixing cannabis with other types of botanicals. And then third, in branding it in a way that is resonant to the experiences consumers are looking for and that tell stories that reflect who your target consumers are. Across that line, across the product ecosystem, we think there's huge opportunity that's still untapped, and we're excited to see what the next few years will bring.
Right. Well, you and I have talked about this at length about the onset of this COVID-19. If that's one of the reasons why people have been shying away from flower and taking on edibles, and with the respiratory issues that come along with coronavirus, there's just so many different factors that you're not sure if it's just trending this way. But it seems like I think a lot of consumers like the convenience that these new options that they're getting allow.
Yeah, that's certainly been the case in Canada, where the our few retail outlets have been simply unable to keep topicals and edibles in stock.
Yeah. Well, we are almost out of time, so I'm going to leave it here. But I want to thank you guys both so much for joining us today. And thank you to the listeners for joining us at Canna Week. Please be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast. And you can find these new stories and more on New Frontier Data's Cannabis Insights Daily. You can subscribe on our website, newfrontierdata.com. I'm your host, Heather Wicklund, and we will see you next time. New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.